You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Hello, joining you on November the 26th. That is the birthday of Tina Turner, the NHL, that's National Hockey League, for you non-American listeners, and the American holiday known to all of us, though not really understood in Europe, as Thanksgiving. My name is Daniel Freiber. I am the host of this episode of the Cycling Podcast, and I'm mainly here today to express my gratitude to my co-pilot, Larry Warbass, for joining me in the cockpit at a time of year, Larry, when getting a blue tick in reply to one of my WhatsApp messages from cyclists, team managers, coaches, seems about as difficult as winning several Stanley Cups. First of all, Larry, hello. Secondly, thank you. And thirdly, where the hell is everyone, Larry? Why does no one reply to my messages at the moment?
Hey, Daniel. Yeah, good to be here. Hi, everyone. And I don't know, Daniel. I mean, that might be a you problem. I'm not
you
sure.
You don't have to answer. I think most people can probably guess. Okay, before we go any further, though, Thanksgiving, so the birthday of Thanksgiving. It's not Thanksgiving today, is it, Larry? That's tomorrow. But Thanksgiving was, when it was sort of declared, I haven't even, you can tell I haven't done the proper research on this. It was officially sort of declared an American holiday. I think it was in, was it George Washington in the 18th century? On November the 26th, that was the first official Thanksgiving. Larry, do you understand much about Thanksgiving? Could you tell a European, could you explain to a European what Thanksgiving is?
Honestly, I don't think I could do a job of it other than...
You eat turkey and pumpkin pie.
Essentially, yeah, your family all gets together. But I mean, as in, I can tell you what we do on Thanksgiving, but I couldn't tell you like why we celebrate Thanksgiving, you know, which... I mean, I don't know. It's something that goes back to like the Native Americans and like the Pilgrims when they came, and I don't know. Maybe they had this meal together that like symbolized friendship or something like that.
We know that it involves the Pilgrims. Yeah. I sort of knew that as well. And yes, Larry. And we'll just return to the point of being very difficult to raise anyone at the moment, Larry. Well, this episode was indeed, it was supposed to be, I'm doing a bit of a deep dive, Larry, and we're going to talk about this in just a moment. A bit of a deep dive that started last week about the 3-year World Tour promotion relegation cycle, which of course just ended. And last week we had the first episode in what is going to be a series called Trapdoor, and it was about Astana, their miraculous survival in the World Tour. This week's episode was supposed to be another installment of that Trapdoor series, some of which is going to be friends of the podcast only, but some of it's going to be on the regular feed. But Larry, I'm hard at work on that and find it quite difficult to contact people in general at the moment. But Larry, this is, you know, we I was talking to a fellow journalist about this today. We just used to cold call people. You just used to sort of open your phone in the morning and just dial random numbers and see who picked up. But now you have to go through this whole, this whole protocol of sending someone a message, seeing do they blue tick me, do they grey tick me, are they
also don't you have are to they go to, like, amenable, team are they accessible? There's a lot of time now. And
well,
stuff.
That as well. Yeah, it's all very sort of arduous and unwieldy, the process. Anyway, Larry, the episode in lieu of the latest installment of Trapdoor, we are going to do a bit of a sort of a lucky dip of recent news stories because we haven't done a sort of regular episode for a couple of weeks, including, well, we're going to talk about, I think, relegation first, but we're going to talk about new team name, NSN. We're going to talk about the UAE building mountains for Tadej Pogacar. Not moving mountains, but building mountains, and so on and so forth. But before we go any further, Larry, first of all, how the devil are you, and what are you up to at the moment?
Yeah, I'm doing pretty well. Just getting back into training after 4 weeks off. So yeah, maybe I've been on the bike now about 2 weeks. So yeah, it's been going pretty well. Been enjoying it. The weather's been, for the most part, quite good here around Nice in the south of France. So yeah, it's kind of enjoyable training this time of year because you're not doing too crazy of training. You're just kind of doing like endurance rides. I mean, pushing a little bit, but nothing crazy. And yeah, sort of just catching up with people after the off season. So yeah, it's a nice time of year. And I always enjoy riding around this time of year because yeah, it's not too stressful yet. So, and then, you know, you can still kind of enjoy life a bit off of the bike, because you aren't like too crazy focused and the training load isn't super high yet. So yeah, it's kind of a nice time of year. It's like just a more relaxed period. So that's what I've been up to.
Larry, you mentioned catching up with people. We see a lot of that on social media, a lot of sort of social riding. You've also been making new acquaintances. You made the acquaintance of someone who listeners may have heard of, I think a couple of weeks ago, Jim Walmsley, yeah. Former winner of the UTMB Ultra Trail Mont Blanc trail run, sort of the kind of Tour de France of trail running. But yeah, that must have been quite exciting. I mean, it would have been for me. It would have been quite exciting for me. Were you able to glean any knowledge that you were able to cross-pollinate with your day job as a professional cyclist?
Yeah, but we had some interesting chats. So yeah, I ran into him at the grocery store, like the grocery store I always go to. Just one day I heard some Americans and then I looked up and I was like, oh, I think that's Jim Walmsley. And then anyway, I went up and introduced myself and we had a chat, and you know, he follows cycling a bit. So, and he had done something with AG2R a few years ago. So, he knew who I was, and then it was kind of cool. Cause then, yeah, we ended up meeting up and, went for a hike. And then I went with him and his wife for a trail run, the other day, which my legs are still trying to recover from. So it was pretty cool. And yeah, we did talk a lot about training and the differences. But we didn't fully, I don't know, we didn't have enough time because, like, actually, I feel like we were both quite interested in the training science and we talked a ton about it, but, you know, we still didn't hash out all the details of everything. So, but yeah, I think we think pretty similarly about training, but he thinks that cyclists do altitude wrong. And yeah, he has a lot of secrets about heat, he thinks. So.
If you had to summarize where he thinks cyclists are going wrong with altitude,
we train too low, he thinks.
Oh, interesting, yeah. Interesting. So you should be training at training at 4,000 meters.
Maybe no. I think it's more just that like we always stay on top of the mountain, but we do all our training at the bottom. Yeah. You know, and it does seem like cyclists are kind of allergic to training up high, which is something that I've kind of thought about a lot as well, but.
But it's also practical. It's also very practical, Larry, isn't it? On a trail run, you can stay at 2,000 meters for 2 hours, 3 hours. If you're a cyclist, you can't really. Well, by the time you've ridden 2 or 3 hours, you probably.
Exactly. I mean, that's the other thing is like, and the other thing is in Europe there are very few plateaus at altitude. You know, so it's like it's hard to train at altitude. But it does seem like a lot of teams like. Try to train lower rather than high, which I think there can be some benefits to training higher. And it was interesting, like, you know, for example, if you look at Uno X, and, you know, we've talked about Olav Alexander Bu, their coach, before, you know, for the guys that published all their data, they have quite a few guys who put all their training and their power and everything online. And when they were at altitude, they were actually doing their efforts all the way up to 2,600 meters or whatever. At Sierra Nevada. So, you know, that's a bit different than a lot of the other teams, and it seemed to work well for quite a lot of those guys in the tour. So it's something interesting, and it's something that, you know, maybe we'll learn more about in the future.
Chute, chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by NordVPN. And as you're a listener to the Cycling Podcast, you can get the very best discount off a NordVPN plan by going to nordvpn.com/TCP. If you follow that link, which is in the episode show notes as well, you'll get an extra 4 months for free when you sign up for a 2-year plan with NordVPN. Now, there's never been a better or more important time to get a NordVPN subscription. A VPN will protect you whenever you are online, whether you're at home or traveling around, whether you're connected to the internet with your laptop or your phone or tablet or even your smart TV. One NordVPN account can be used on up to 10 devices, so it will keep all of your internet connections safe and secure. And that's really important these days, especially with the rise of phishing attempts trying to hijack people's data online. You can protect all of your most valuable private information, such as your bank details, passwords, and online identity with your NordVPN account. It's really, really easy to use. You just download the app, activate it, choose your location, and when you're traveling abroad, you can switch your location so that you can carry on watching your favorite streaming services or sports events when you're out of the country, just as if you were at home. NordVPN's threat protection also protects you from viruses, malicious malware, and phishing websites. So a NordVPN subscription available with 4 months extra for free when you get a 2-year plan at nordvpn.com/TCP.
Well, Larry, as I said in part one, this is going to be a lucky dip, a whistle-stop tour through various news headlines over the last 2 or 3 weeks. But I wanted to start where, well, as I already said, we should have began this episode, or the subject of this episode we're supposed to concentrate on, which was still the promotion and relegation from the World Tour. And as I mentioned last week, we had a deep dive into Astana's strategy, and I've been concentrating in my research, Larry, over the last few days on Cofidis, what happened with them. Of course, we believe they were relegated. And Uno X, who of course got promotion. Now, one of the other reasons, as well as people not picking up the phone, Larry, that I wasn't able to finish one of these episodes this week, was that I've been told by Cofidis that they're not 100% sure yet whether they will be relegated. And this is a sort of farcical, Python-esque situation that we're in. In professional cycling, the date is the 26th of November. We are just over a month from the start of 2026, and we still don't know who is going to be in the World Tour. Of course, we keep hearing about this merger that's supposed to take place between Lotto and Intermarché. We're still none the wiser as to exactly what form that's going to take, which riders are going to be out of jobs, which staff are going to be out of their jobs. Now, Larry, I was told today that there will be a team launch of whom, whether it's Lotto Intermarché, whether it's Intermarché or something resembling what existed before, that will be on the 12th of January. And I was given no further details about that. Have you heard anything, Larry, on the grapevine about whether this merger is happening or not?
No, I don't. I mean, I have to say, I don't really know much about it. I was at this Beijing Criterium over the weekend, and I was speaking to a Lotto rider, and for him, he thought like everything was going on like they expected. So yeah, I don't know. I guess we'll see what happens.
Well, Larry, there is a lot of sort of uncertainty at the moment, but we think we know what has happened in terms of promotion relegation. We think Cofidis have lost their World Tour license. We think Astana, we're pretty sure Astana have kept theirs. And Uno X are going to be in the World Tour. Of course, there are other sort of checks and balances that have to take place. The UCI announced the composition of the divisions, as it were, on the 10th of December. So we should have a little bit more clarity then. But Larry, I just wanted to ask you, and before we started recording today, I said in the course of really doing a bit of a deep dive into this promotion relegation saga, I got quite into it, Larry. And I've sort of persuaded myself that this has actually been a positive sort of innovation for professional cycling. If I have a criticism of it, well, you can criticize the sort of points allocation itself. And we've gone into that in the last couple of weeks with, Vasi from Astana last week, and even the week before with Matt White, who's now at Movistar. You can quibble with that. But my other big quibble with it is that it's not given enough exposure. And we in the media have probably not talked about it enough, because I think there are some really good storylines and some really interesting storylines there. Maybe too concentrated in year three of the 3-year cycle, and it would be in everyone's interest, well, not necessarily in the struggling team's interest, but it would maybe be an idea to think about 2-year cycles rather than 3-year cycles. But what do you think about it generally?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it is interesting, like you said, if you think about the end of this season, there was a lot of talk about all the relegation. And I mean, it brought in like 30 different storylines and really different dynamics to every single race because, you know, it was like, oh, you have to be careful. Like, you know, I mean, the problem is if Uno X goes up the road, like Cofidis won't let them go. And then, you know, it was like, it actually totally affected the dynamics of the racing, which I don't know, people could say is good or bad, but it definitely added a lot of storylines to the racing. Then, you know, you saw like the way Asana was racing this year. You know, they instead of working for one guy, they'd be going for like three guys in the top 10, and often they were successful. And so you just saw like it changed the way the racing was, but I guess it did give a lot more storylines to the races beyond the like typical like, oh, like Tade won, you know? So I guess it does make for a lot more races within a race, which I guess is what they should be going for. But yeah, then it you know, it was pretty interesting to follow the whole Uno X Cofidis thing, you know, throughout the end of the year. And at the beginning of the year, you know, everyone thought it was impossible for Astana to stay in the World Tour. And then they were like comfortably in by the end of the season. So, yeah, I have to say it definitely was an interesting, it was an interesting, I guess, the way it played out this year. And then, you know, in addition to that, you know, for example, for our team, for Tudor Pro Cycling, it was super important to be at the beginning of the year. We thought one of the two first pro teams, so that we get automatic invites. And then, you know, by the end of the year, they added another team, but still we kept the objective of two first pro teams. So, and then, you know, for us, then that changed once Uno X decided to go into the World Tour. Then, like, you know, we became, I think, the first pro team or whatever, considering Uno X moving up. So, yeah, it just totally changes all the dynamics. And I guess, though, if you think about it, in the last relegation cycle, it was like Israel Premier Tech or whatever they were called at that time and Lotto that got demoted. And I don't know if there was anyone else. I don't know if there was a third one or just those two.
Just those two.
But then they both started out super strong, like this second cycle, you know, the next cycle, this last cycle. And, you know, I think they really doubled down on like getting points and the way that they attacked the racing. And I think that's sort of been something teams have learned a lot more over the past couple of years is like how to get more points. But then the, you know, people might say like Astana's strategy, I mean, was a bit almost like annoying and not annoying, but like, they really took advantage of sort of like almost loopholes in the strategy. You know, I mean, not that they're loopholes, but they're going to like these tiny races Asia and wherever, which, I mean, okay, they did have a Chinese sponsor, so that also probably was beneficial this year. But I think they were...
It's kind of absurd that you can have, and we talked about this last week in some depth, that you can have a 100-day difference between the team that races the most and the team that races the least.
And that I think is a big problem, but I don't know, maybe I mentioned this the last time we were on the podcast or that I was on the podcast. I might've said something that I was thinking about is like, what if we put a limit on the number of race days that teams can participate in, or everyone gets to do, I don't know what teams do right now, but what did they do, like 300 or like 250 or something?
Yeah. Astana was the most last year and they did 320, I believe.
So say we say teams can't do more than 275 race days or something, you know, because the problem is if you're on one of these teams that then is doing 300 something races all over the world, you're going to definitely get over raced. And I don't think that's good in general. So I think having a more reduced calendar is probably better for the riders in general.
And the limit on the squad size is also a bit of a false limit in the sense that for the teams that also have a Devo team, you can add another 15 or 20 riders, which we heard again last week for Astana. And some of the teams don't have the luxury of bringing in Devo riders for the sort of 0.2 category races.
I do think, though, that that's like a really good thing that has changed over the last years is that the Devo guys can race, because it's hard to really fill all the holes with, you know, the pro riders, the pro team riders. And I think that's a nice incentive for all pro teams to get a Devo team, you know, and then I think that sort of advances and professionalizes the whole sort of system. Okay, maybe people argue then it kills like the lower levels. Like I know in France, that's a big deal. They say like all these Devo teams are killing amateur cycling in France. And that's probably true, but maybe the system needs to update and evolve.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's hard.
Yeah, some would say it's also killing the pro Conti division and the Conti division. I mean, we're going to see this year at the Tour de France, there's not a huge amount of competition for the last wildcard spot.
Which is crazy.
Yeah. Just also on the riding for points, racing for points. Now, I don't know if you've had much experience of this, Larry, going back through your career, but I also think that we, particularly as kind of journalists, observers of the sports, we're guilty of focusing, being completely 100% focused on who wins a race to the exclusion of everything else. And often, you know, I kind of feel guilty afterwards when you're interviewing riders after finish. Often you're sort of default instinctively to a rider who's finished second, third, fourth, maybe been in a break, you kind of adopt the stance, adopt the posture of sympathy or of kind of commiseration. And actually sometimes quite quickly you realize that's not how the rider feels at all. They're almost expecting to be congratulated. And rightly so, they're in a bike race of 170 people. But I do think that there is too much focus on who wins, because we are talking about races with 175 riders, and particularly in the era of Pogacar, Van der Poel, etc. There can be a fourth place that's a brilliant performance. There can be a 10th place that's a career best ride for some guys in the field. And we don't often acknowledge that. And I think there needs to be a little bit more attention in that direction.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably true. I mean, I still think, yeah, winning or podium is really the most important. And then individually, it can be important to certain riders, but I mean, I don't think there are that many people that want to read an article about Larry Warbass finishing 12th and being happy about it. You know, I don't know.
Look, but Larry, if at the end of every race, and I said this a few weeks ago, if at the end of every race on TV we saw the league table of the teams and we knew exactly how much every race was contributing to the league table, and it was kind of, it was very present in our minds that at the moment Tudor are eighth and they are, you know, I mean, obviously in other sports, there is a sort of graded reward system. I don't know whether in cycling we could have some sort of equivalent of the playoffs in American sports, where there are incentives in this ranking system beyond just promotion relegation. I mean, we've seen pretty clearly that UAE have the incentive. It's obviously very important to them to be the number one team in the world, and the probably sort of financial incentives as well. But beyond that, the difference between finishing sort of second and sixth and seventh and eighth, okay, probably comes up in conversations between the team manager and the sponsors when they sort of meet at the end of the year. But otherwise, there aren't huge incentives. There isn't a prize money incentive, is there?
No.
For example.
No.
But that's maybe something that UCI could think about. I mean, the prize money, they can't just magic that, but creating some other kind of incentive
in terms of
final position.
But what kind of incentives could they?
I don't know. Playoffs. How could we create?
Great, we get to race more if we're season. Doing well.
Yeah, exactly.
Awesome.
November. Extend the season to November. Yeah. Then we really wouldn't know who's going to be in the world.
Well, I'm not going to hire you for the.
Okay. Well, Larry. Talking about, we'll move on to our next item. Talking about which teams are going to be in the World Tour next year. We have a new team, or a new team name at least. We're going to have a team called NSN. NSN stands for Never Say Never. And this will be the team formerly known as Israel Premier Tech, who of course ended the 2025 season in contested circumstances after all the pro-Palestine demonstrations at the Vuelta a España in particular, and there was pressure on them and their team owner, in particular Sylvain Adams, for the team to lose its Israeli identity. We've talked a lot before about exactly what that represented. Israel, was it funded by the government? No, it wasn't, but Sylvain Adams saw it very much as a vehicle to promote Israel. No longer. The team is now going to be called Never Say Never. What is Never Say Never? It's a international sports and entertainment group co-founded by Spanish football legend Andres Iniesta. They have a diverse portfolio spanning football, music, documentary production, art exhibitions. They also have an investment in a Danish football team, second division football team. And the takeover of the license is a joint venture with a company called Stoneweg. Stoneweg's a Swiss real estate business. They actually joined Israel Premier Tech, what was then Israel Premier Tech, as a co-sponsor in the summer, along with something called Icona Group, with which Stoneweg has merged. Part of the DLC Stoneweg buy into NSN. So in a way, the funding is coming from Stoneweg, I believe. The company has a global network with operations in regions including Spain, Japan, US, Latin America, and UAE. Larry, very intriguing this, not least because, well, most of us didn't see it coming. We heard some rumors last week, or about 10 days ago, there were all sorts of rumors swirling about Visit Rwanda being the new sponsor and various other things. Incidentally, I should point out as well that the team will have a Swiss license, but will also have a Spanish base. The operational structure will be, I think, either in Barcelona or Girona, possibly.
Yeah, I think they're just keeping their same base that they already had. Yeah.
Okay. And of course, there had been a lot of talk amid those protests at the Vuelta about what this meant for the team at the Tour de France in 2026. Tour de France, of course, starts from Barcelona. Other rumors at this stage, one very significant rumor is that Biniam Gamay is about to sign for this team and he will be riding for them next year. Larry, again, what is being said on the grapevine? What has been said? Or what do you make of all of this?
Yeah, I mean, I know about as much as you do. I did also hear that Girmay would be going there. And yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I know they're having their training camp right now. They posted some photos, which was interesting that they were on Factor bikes because all the rumors say that they're probably going to be on Scott bikes. Because Factor said they were going to stop with the team after this last year. And yeah, I mean, I think they got really lucky to, if it becomes Scott, you know, I think, but those are both like amazing bike brands. So they got really lucky that, Q365 changed from Scott to Pinarello for next season, because that opened up the door to have Scott if Factor does indeed stop. So, you know, I think the way it worked out is like pretty fortunate for all the riders, at least, you know, is like, you know, I think they found, some new companies to work with. I imagine, you know, they're still supported by Sylvain Adams, you know, where, you know, the guy who was sort of like the benefactor of the team before. But, you know, I have no idea. But, you know, I think adding these new sponsors, changing the registration of the team, I think that's probably beneficial for them for next season, just the way that things were going at the end of this year. So yeah, I think it's good for them that they were able to sort of rebrand and change their image, but I think the sort of structure and base of the team will all stay the same, you know, same riders, same staff, everyone.
We don't know if, well, to our knowledge, Sylvain Adams is no longer involved. However, there will be some skepticism about that, Larry. Or a lot of people will be sort of thinking the same thing, that somehow he's lurking in the shadows, whether there's some sort of residual funding from him or some other kind of involvement. I said before we started recording, Larry, very, very frivolously, Larry, facetiously, actually, I should say, the idea that he was still lurking in the shadows kind of brought to mind, there's a famous, I said to you, I described it to you, Larry, as the Shaquille O'Neal. And I said, you know Shaq, Larry? And you said, Daniel, I know who Shaquille O'Neal is. Anyway, there's a famous meme of him. He's a very big gentleman, of course, trying to, hiding behind a very spindly tree. And I wondered whether in a few weeks' time we find out that Sylvain Adams is somewhere lurking in the shadows. I hope not, obviously, for all involved, because the team has suggested that is not the case. And hopefully it is a bit of a fresh start for the riders.
But,
a lot of
riders, even if the money was coming from him, but then it's a totally rebranded team, is that an issue?
Some would argue not, because a lot of people's issues with this
was representing.
With this operation was it was representing, it was a propaganda organ,
right,
effectively for a state that they whose actions they didn't approve of. So if it's his money, I mean, this was always the kind of you could call it a mystery. This was always the thing that caused a lot of incomprehension, that Sylvain Adams had chosen to tie the identity of the team to something which was and became certainly last year extremely contentious and inflammatory. And he could easily, maybe when he founded the team, he could easily have chosen one of his other businesses or some other identity, some other name, and linked the team to that instead. So now, yeah, let's imagine that maybe he does have some roles still. There will be some people who were very upset at the team continuing to race last year who will be less upset now, providing that, or as will be the case, there is no explicit link to Israel. Mm-hmm. So, Larry, we shall see. We will keep our eagle eyes peeled, but we'll be finding out in the next few days. I think the team may have a media day at the start of December, when I'm sure more will be explained about exactly what the structure of the team is. We talked about what we mentioned there, Binyam Gamay. We think that is pretty much a done deal. I certainly expect him to be unveiled any day now. Larry, before our next break, I'm going to mention another story that has been in the headlines over the last few days. It's been a bit of a slow news week, news fortnight, and it's in these sort of slow news periods that stories like this tend to gain a lot of attention. Marcel Kittel did a podcast with our colleagues at Domestique, and he was asked, and I must confess, I haven't listened to the whole podcast, and I don't know whether this was on the back of, in a similar vein, Mark Cavendish was asked about doping in the promotion of his latest book in the UK a couple of weeks ago, 2 or 3 weeks ago, and he made comments there about cycling being the cleanest sport in the world. And I don't know whether that was picked up on and then sort of put to Marcel Kittel. Anyway, what Marcel Kittel said on the subject of doping in cycling currently was, "I don't believe that cycling is clean now, absolutely not. You'd be very ignorant about the facts to suggest it was. There will always be people who are trying to cheat the system. We just have to be sure that we really safeguard what we have and the progress that we've made and make sure that these are single cases and not a widespread doping system that we had in the 1990s. Now, Larry, I thought this was a lot of fuss. So I saw a lot of fuss about absolutely nothing here. I think that Marcel Kittel, I don't think he was suggesting that the sport is addled with doping, addled with cheats. I think he was simply stating the objective fact that there are still riders who get caught. It may not be the number that it once was. And that alone, and we can probably assume that there are more riders cheating than get caught, but that alone tells us that cycling is not clean. It can't be clean until the sport is 100% clean.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I think, like you said, I didn't listen to the interview, so it's really hard to know, you know, if it got taken out of context or it surely got taken out of context, because I also saw these quotes and I was like, oh, like, what is this guy on about? But, you know, I mean, I agree in the fact that, like, you know, I mean, well, I agree with both that I mean, cleanest sport in the world, I have no idea, but like, I do think cycling is generally quite clean, you know? And I mean, there's always going to be people who cheat. In the 90s or whatever, it was probably the majority of the peloton. All I'm trying to say is I think in general, cycling's quite clean, you know? And so I think that's cool. But yeah, maybe it was just like this. That's how the podcast went, and then it just got taken out of context. But yeah, so it's hard to say, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sort of contradicting my own actions here, but I would suggest that it's always a good idea when you see quotes like this to go back and listen to the whole podcast or everything that was said, because tone of voice matters, the question matters as well. And when a quote is pulled out and slapped on social media, I should mention that Marcel Kittel has already been in the news for something else. And that is that he is rejoining sort of professional cycling circus as a sprint coach. He's going to be the sprint coach at the Unibet Rose Rockets, who, of course, for next year have signed Dylan Groenewegen. They've also signed Rory Townsend, Wout Poels, among other riders. And as we've already said, we think they've got a pretty damn good chance of being the final wildcard pick in the Tour de France 2026. Larry, I saw you pictured, selfied maybe, on social media with Wout Poels the other day. I think he's been a fairly habitual training partner of yours.
Yeah.
And that's because he lives on the Côte d'Azur. Is he now moving back to the Netherlands?
He is, yeah. So this is his last week here. So he'll move back to the Netherlands at the end of the week.
Why?
I think that was just sort of always the plan. He didn't know if he was going to keep going after the season, but he, you know, bought his forever dream home in the Netherlands, as he would say, and, you know, was planning to finish around this season. And then he was like, oh, if this year went well, he would maybe think about doing another year. And so then he thought, actually, it would be cool to do one more year. And the Unibet Tiedemann Rockets came to him with this proposal. And he thought, you know what, I still really enjoy riding my bike. I still have a good level, you know, and even doing some smaller races would be exciting and motivating. And maybe it would ease the transition, you know, after being here for like 8-9 years, moving back to the Netherlands, you know, it's not all this change at once. He didn't expect when he signed that they would potentially get into a Grand Tour, and now it looks like they might have a good shot at the Tour de France. So yeah, it's pretty cool. And it looks like they've made some good moves to move in that direction.
Mm. Rory Townsend?
Yeah.
Good signing?
Yeah, I think it's a good signing. I mean, I don't know him very much, but obviously he must be strong the way he won Hamburg this year. Then they signed Victor Lefebvre, who can always pull off some big rides.
The Mercurial Victor Lefebvre.
Exactly. Among others. So I think they'll have a solid team.
This episode of Unfiltered is brought to you by Google Gemini. U.S. college students get Gemini's Pro plan free for 1 year and use the best model in the world for multimodal understanding. So whether you're uploading a video to get feedback on your presentation, uploading a photo of your homework to ask for extra help, or transcribing notes from a lecture you missed, Gemini 3 Pro can help. I'm honestly so happy and excited for all the college students out there, because I wish this was around back when I was in school. This is such a game changer and so useful. I'm honestly a little jealous. So if you want to try it out, sign up to get more access to Google's most accurate model, Gemini 3 Pro. Unlimited image uploads, pro-level image editing, higher limits in Notebook LM, Gemini in Gmail and Docs, 2 terabytes of storage, and more. All you have to do is visit gemini.google/students to learn more and sign up. Terms apply.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news. It doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Larry, something else that caught my eye. Again, I think this was Domestique that pulled out some stats on pro cycling stats. Pro cycling stats tracked World Tour speeds since 2001. And they highlighted the remarkable acceleration in speeds over the last few years. Between 2001 and 2020, average barely changed. This was in World Tour races. World Tour, of course, didn't exist in 2001, but races equivalent to that. Barely changed average speeds. But since the pandemic season, speeds have climbed year after year. 41.2 in 2022. 41.8 in 2023, 42.2 in 2024, 42.8 in 2025. Larry, what is going on? And this inflection point during COVID, obviously we talked about it a lot at the time, and we had some wacky theories at the time. You know, I remember us having conversations, semi-serious conversations, about whether spending 5 months on a turbo trainer was actually causing some riders to sort of advance and do more kind of torque work or whatever it might have been. But there was no doubt that it seemed like a big inflection point. And maybe with sort of 10 more years of hindsight, it will be really interesting when people go back to sort of study what did go on and why this did happen. We have over the years discussed various things that could have contributed. But now, in November 2025, Larry, what would immediately comes to your mind when you hear those figures?
I mean, definitely equipment is probably like number one, you know? So if I were to say probably one of the biggest advancements in speed came from switching from tubulars to tubeless, that's like a huge difference. So that's a huge gain in speed. Then, you know, I think we fully switched, like, we all had climbing bikes probably around 2019, and then probably, yeah, around 2020 was where everyone started to really ride aero bikes, you know? I mean, as in the majority of the peloton. I remember in the 2020 Giro, we did not have an aero bike, and we were one of the only teams. And I remember that really struggling on the flat, like, due to that, you know? then, you know, I mean, even then, for example, our clothing, our helmets, like now everyone's wearing aero road helmets. Then now everyone's wearing skin suits, and these skin suits are getting more and more optimized every year. So all of that would account for a sizable amount of that. Then the other thing is, like, the races are opening up way earlier than they used to, you know? So now I think teams are realizing the way to exploit their advantage or magnify the differences in strength is by starting to ride hard earlier. Whereas, like, it used to be, you know, the final started, I don't know, 40K to go or 30K to go or whatever. Yeah. Or, you know, the second to last climb, they would go a bit harder. And then the last climb, you'd go full gas, yeah, you know?
I mean, we've talked before, Larry, about, and that analysis is over the whole, that analyzes whole races, and we've said it would be interesting to go back and analyze average speeds. I suspect the difference would be even bigger if you analyze just the first 2 hours of races.
Yeah, that's true. It's true.
Over those periods. But it would be interesting, Larry, to sort of think about whether there were single eureka moments, single races, which opened, whether it's riders or director sportifs or coaches, eyes to the possibility of opening up races, as you put it earlier. I mean, I think of races, it was the 2019 Amstel, wasn't it, with Van der Poel, where he sort of did his famous kind of, you know, sort of comic book hero virtuoso ride. That kind of stands out to me. Generally, the style of, well, Pogacar burst onto the scene in 2019. There was a fair amount of it then, but we've seen many other examples and many more extreme examples since then. But I wonder whether there were sort of single performances in those years that really sort of changed the way everyone thought about
it. I think another thing is that I do remember a definite change, and I don't remember what year this was. It was like maybe sometime around 2021 or something, where, you know, I think it was like with the rise of these few guys becoming so dominant, it was like a lot of good riders were starting to realize that they had zero chance if they waited to the finish line. And then all of a sudden, on days where you would have thought like it was just going to be a token breakaway, like all these really like big names were starting to try for the breakaway. And I remember being like, holy shit, this is crazy. You know, like none of these guys would have ever even gone in a breakaway before. And now everyone is trying in the breakaway for the breakaway because they know like that is their only chance to win. Whereas before, so many more people had a chance to win out of the peloton. Now I think we've seen this rise of like dominance of so few riders and maybe teams that like all these riders who would have never thought about going in the breakaway in the previous era, now the breakaway is their only chance to win a race. So I think you see way bigger fights for breakaways because way stronger riders or bigger names are trying to go in these breaks. Mm-hmm. So I definitely think that's also been an evolution. And then, you know, that's not to mention all the nutrition, everything like that. But yeah. Mm-hmm.
Just one final thing on this, Larry. Is there anything that you can think of in terms of feedback that improved, that made a sort of quantum leap? Because I always feel that that's been a big factor as well. People like David Epstein, author of a book called mm-hmm. Range, talks about this, has talked about this a lot. And obviously, this is something that's been revolutionized in all sports, but particularly in cycling. There's so much data now, and that's so valuable in terms of advancing your performance. I mean, our listeners will know that from their own sort of use of things like Strava compared to riding 20, 30 years ago. It's really valuable. It's really useful when you know exactly how well you performed on any given day. I mean, you mentioned there nutrition. I think there's been a lot of, there's a lot more feedback on that score than there once was. Maybe in terms of performance data, that had already sort of plateaued around about 20, you know, but well, even before 2020. Is there anything else that sort of come online?
I would say not many people were eating that much until around 2020. You know, I remember end of 2019 was when I first discovered like that you could fuel, you know, like 100 grams an hour or something, you know, and then 2020 was like, I think I was the only person on my team who was trying to consume that many carbohydrates, you know? And it wasn't until like 1 or 2 years later that I feel like everyone was starting to adopt that, you know? So that probably came around then. I mean, yeah, I mean, I guess if you're going to talk about 2020, a lot of people spent a lot of time on the indoor trainer. Maybe they were like also unintentionally heat training, you know what I mean? So, I mean, the heat training has made a difference, but that's more recent. I think, like, let's see. I mean, also race programs have been optimized. So, you know, guys are racing less. So every race becomes more important then. And, you know, I definitely have noticed that, like, there are no easy races anymore or, you know, very, very few. Whereas, like, there used to be a lot more easy races. So that's something that's just changed. Because I guess also maybe with the whole points thing, every race has become more important. Whereas before, yeah, I guess that might even be another thing is like some of these smaller races, you know, you think of a race like, I don't know, maybe like Trofeo Laguaglia in Italy, okay? In the, like for quite a few years, it was just like, oh, whatever, it's a small race, it's not that far away, we'll go or whatever. Now it's like, oh, it's a 1-point pro, it's easy to get to, it's not like the crazy highest level, so we'll send some really good riders to get a result. But then there's 10 teams that have the same idea, so then all of a sudden there's like a bunch of really good riders, you know? So all these races, I would say the importance of points and everything has probably raised the level of a lot of smaller races, which then probably raises the speed at the same time. So I think there's just been all these tiny little factors that have added up. But yeah.
You could throw in TV coverage as well. You mentioned a race like Laguaglia. Not many people used to be able to watch that, and it was only people who lived in Italy. But in the last sort of 5 or 6 years, we've seen with streaming platforms and so on and so forth, most races are now available to view or have been, and I think that probably makes a mm-hmm. difference as well. As well as broadcasting races for longer, there are a lot of races that are now broadcast in their entirety. Just incidentally, Larry, you mentioned race programs there. Talking to Vasilis Anastopoulos of Astana last week about their use of the data scientist, Morgan Sorsin, I think his name is, did make me think that that is a position that we're going to see in every World Tour team quite soon.
Yeah,
every
I would say most teams probably have data scientists already. Yeah.
Really? Okay. Larry, next couple of things. One of them, well, which seemed like a bit of a joke at first when I first read it, I think it was Marca in Spain reported that in the UAE, which of course is going to be the venue for the 2028 Cycling World Road Race Championships, they are building a hill or multiple hills for, well, presumably, possibly, with the intention of adding elevation to the World Championship Road Race course. Now, as I said, I thought this was a bit of a joke, but in the last few hours, people have been digging a bit deeper into this, and there's now photographic evidence of these mounds, dunes, that have been, it seemed to have been built. We don't know if it's for the explicit purpose of the World Championships in 2028. But Larry, what do you
make of this? I mean, the funny thing is, like, this is a rumor that's been around the Peloton for a long time, actually. I mean, so this goes back, like, quite a few years. And I mean, like, 2 to 3 years, probably. Is that, like, as soon as this came out, people were already, like, they were, as soon as they were awarded the Worlds, people said that they were going to build a hill or whatever for Pogacar. But then what I had heard this year was that they weren't going, it was going to be a flat race because maybe the UCI had asked them, that they said that they wanted a flat Worlds or whatever, you know? So what I had assumed more recently that it would not happen anymore. But then now that they talked about this, or, you know, I mean, I think Merlier said it off the cuff, but from everything I understood that it was going to be flat now, even though I had understood that they were building a hill. But I don't know, maybe they are building a hill, but I mean, also do we not know, I mean, this could just be also like, you know, what do you call those like trash dump hills, you know? I mean, I don't know, like, it could just be something like that. Yeah. I don't know, you know, maybe it has nothing to do with cycling. Yeah. But.
And a few of those have been used in bike races over the years for various reasons. Incidentally, if anyone's curious about who has any evidence of these hills, these dunes, or whatever it is that's been built, a triathlete called Volker Voigt, who is German but based in the UAE, I believe, he posted a video today where he shows what we presume to be the hills that, or hill or hills that might feature in 2028 Worlds. Larry, one more thing I wanted to ask you about, and this is also, well, this is to do with a different kind of innovation. Again, casting around our sort of colleagues on various websites, podcasts, elsewhere in Europe, and stories they've been writing over the last couple of weeks. There's an interesting interview on Bici Pro, that's an Italian site, with Luca Guercilena, who, of course, is team manager of Little Trek, talking about safety in cycling and the need to make this sport safer for you guys. And he talked again, this is not the first time we've heard this mentioned, but he talks about the need to study or investigate the possibility of using airbags. This was something that Christian Prudhomme, I think, mentioned as well earlier in the year, of adapting clothing anyway, and possibly equipping cycling clothing with airbags. Now, this is maybe not as crazy as it sounds, because as of last year, these airbags have been mandatory in speed disciplines in the Skiing World Cup races. And I had a bit of a look at these, Larry, at the product that exists, made by, I think 90% who use them in Skiing World Cup use the same product, and it's made by Dainese, Italian.
Yeah, like motorcycle brand or something.
Terminology.
No relation to my team.
And they...
I asked.
And they have... Oh, you did. They have a product, Larry. I've got the name of it here somewhere, but it weighs... I think it weighs about 800 grams. Here is the DS Ski Evo. It weighs about 800 grams. And I was sort of reading into whether this has been seen as a success. It seems to be that there are some mixed feelings about it. It's not very practical in the sense that if the airbag engages, then it has to be sort of sent back to Dainese, and they have to kind of stuff it back in or whatever it is. And this means that the skiers have to have several of these sort of on hand. There's also a sort of widespread fear that it might deploy by mistake. And obviously there are other considerations. Weight is not a big one in downhill skiing, or you could say that added weight is even an advantage, but it's a little bit unwieldy. And there's also sort of very mixed evidence about how many accidents it's actually prevented, or how many bad injuries it's actually prevented. There are even those who say that it could exacerbate injuries. Larry, any thoughts?
I mean, I think anything that could help make our sport more safe is welcome. But yeah, I don't really know how they function, and I'd have to read a bit more up on them to see how it could work, you know. But I mean, yeah, I do think we could do certain things to improve our safety, but whether airbags are realistic or not, I don't really know, you know. I mean, I'm sure in the near future they'll be able to create some technology that would be functional and usable. But yeah, I don't know about the ones that currently exist.
Okay, that's that then. I can see it happening. I mean, these I was very curious to see these, Larry, and it is very much sort of concentrated around the kind of upper torso. It is really a vest, and again, I have to defer to people with greater expertise than me. It's kind of difficult, even when you do see them deploy, it's sort of difficult to see how it would, in some instances with certain types of fall, prevent serious injury. But presumably, you know, there's a lot of research gone into it, although I think even the manufacturer would acknowledge that it's not going to prevent all serious injuries, and of course the lower body is still very much exposed. So there you go. Larry, just finally, before we move on to something else, we're going to close out with a short interview today. But your movements over the next couple of weeks, you're back in training, I presume, and you've got a training camp coming up, is that right?
Yeah, so we head to training camp on the 9th of December. We're going to Morera, just next to Calpe. And yeah, so, you know, the pretty standard training camp in December. I think the majority of teams are in the same spot, so should be good. Hopefully we'll have good weather and yeah, have a nice block out there.
You mentioned earlier you're already back in training. Is there any sort of hashtag for Larry Warbus's winter training this year? Is there any big sort of...
No, but maybe I should make one, you know.
Big kind of ethos or resolution.
No, not yet. Maybe I need to wait for January 1 to do that. And finish it by January 20th or something. But yeah, no. No. Just, I think, focusing on the basics and, just enjoying.
We need a slogan, Larry. Next time we need you to come back with a
I'll work on the
some
slogan.
Kind of snappy slogan. Maybe back to basics will be our placeholder for now.
Sounds good.
Okay. Well, Larry, thank you very much for joining us today. I said we're going to play it with something else. Our final item today, a couple of weeks ago, it was the Ruler Live event in London. And, well, that was the occasion for one team to make a big announcement. I'm talking about a team called Team Armani. And they are an ambitious project founded in 2020 by a gentleman called Michel Delagrange. I'm going to say in French, human rights lawyer and the late writer Sula Kangangi. The core mission of this project was to promote inclusivity in cycling and particularly create opportunities for riders based in Africa. Over the last couple of years, well, there's been various sort of strands to this project, but essentially men's and women's teams. This year, the men have been racing gravel races in various places. They've also got a development team. Black Mamba is the development team. But at Ruler Live, about 10 days ago, they also announced that next year they are going to have a women's team in the continental division. And they also have a very, very ambitious goal. But I think it's a realistic goal, having spoken to people involved, of competing in the Tour de France with a completely black African team, women's Tour de France, within 3 years or in 3 years. Larry, I wanted to find out more about this. So I spoke a few days ago to one of the gentlemen involved in the project and has been for a couple of years now. Scarbu Gamay, Larry, you know, a former colleague of yours, spent many years in the pro peloton. He's been doing fantastic work over the last couple of years with Amani. As I said, it's a really exciting project, and you'll hear from Scarbu's enthusiasm and energy that I think it's got great chance of succeeding. So we're going to hear from Scarbu, just plays out today. We'll be back in a few days, or I'll be back with, I think, Michele Pellacci and Brian Nigar. That's our sort of Giro d'Italia, or part of our Giro d'Italia lineup, because on the 1st of December, I forget which day of the week that is, I think it's Monday, we've got the Giro presentation in Rome. So we're going to hear about what the route's going to be like next week, and we'll be back shortly thereafter to tell you all about it. So you're going to hear from Scarbu Gamay, and before you do, I'm going to thank you, Larry.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's a big week for us as a team, because like when you look back as a team Armani, the last 4 years, every progression, and since last year and this year, it's a big step, because last year, 2 years, like 2024, and we had this idea to create a main continental team, and with 10 years, plan to be able to do a big race like a Tour de France and to be in the highest level, and also with the men, with the women, that also we were like planning, and we can arrive in a short time. This was like born, this idea, last year, and this year we had a Conti team with the men. It was a successful year for us, been racing in the gravel, and those races like was mixed, and still was focused on more on the gravel, I would say, because we did more races. But this year we were really shifted all in with the women. We switched that, we see the potential on the women, because especially after we had a girls from Ethiopia and from Rwanda, where we bring them to Eton and we did power tests, and we see the potential what they have. And also we took them to the first UCI African races. They were like just beating them like easily, and like they were in the podium all the time, and they won the jersey. And more than that, I think we see the potential when we really did the power test, and then we had athletes like they could really perform like highest number, like top 20 in the best athletes in the world. And like we'd say, okay, there's a big potential here in the women's side that we didn't see, and we could invest in there, and we create that idea, that 3 year dream, and to be able, or goal, like, to be able to achieve to Tour de France and create the first woman African team that to be able to launch for Armani. So it was a big week for us because the women team, we were already, to create a Conti team, we was already idea that we created last year. But we were not sure with the potential. And I knew there was a potential, to be honestly, because I know the women, how they race in Ethiopia and everything, but the watts per kilo, I was not really expected would be really high, as like close to the women that we see in the level of the world cycling now. So we were all into that, and it gives us so much energy as a team. And also I think it's a big and smart move for us as a team, the decision we make. Switch that to let's invest in women, and we could like we would be in 3 years to be to do Tour de France, and we believe in that. That's a realistic dream for us to be able to chase with all this we have, and with the people around it.
You accomplished incredible things to get where you were, and it needed a lot of where needed you to bring a lot of things together. The women on Team Armani. What's a typical story? How are they coming into cycling, or how are you bringing them into cycling?
So this is something that the people in the world of cycling, they don't know, is which is as a Team Armani, like we try to work. The first thing I did is like Team Armani members and the people who works behind this is the social media, even the team owner, Mikael, just to push him come to Tigray and Ethiopia. See what kind of the world is there, like with the cycling and the culture and how the team invest and all these things. That's the thing. Also, the big question mark: how like Eritreans and Ethiopian from Tigray they become a pro? This is people behind the scene, they don't understand. And I know where I come from: the setup, the racing, the competition, the the people, how they love the sport. It's insane. And then I try to bring Mikael and all these people to Tigray to see what's going on and to speak to their teams. And they were impressed. And that's also something for us. People think we need to develop like talent ID and like all these project academy to build it from now to be able to make a future champion. But there is already exist that people doesn't see like in Tigray, in Asmara, in Eritrea. It's a big culture of cycling, and like we could do 40 races per year. It's really the competition is not like the numbers of the athletes not big, but it's like there is a competition, and that's how they create the high level. That's how we get the women. Most of our women come from Ethiopia, because also that's why we registered the team in Ethiopia, because we could have a lot of numbers from there. And that's how we get those women, those talented women. And for next year in our squad, we have from DRC, Kenya, and also Uganda, and also Rwanda, but most of them is from Ethiopia. And on the list that they're going to race those races for next year in Europe is most of them, 95% of the Ethiopian athletes, because they are already in the level that, on the higher level to be able to perform. So, for example, we have athletes, like I said, they have watts, 5 more watts per kilo for 20 minutes. And they just come with this. We didn't do anything behind the scene. Like, we didn't build them. They just come to us with those strengths and the powers. So it's also, there is a lot of story behind it. For example, those women, most of the women we had, is they come from after like really bad civil war that in Ethiopia, they lost 3 years of from training. They lost like two of those girls. They had also a baby on that during time because there was no racing. There was a civil war. And once soon as everything settled and stopped the war, they resume their riding, and they are with us now. And it's just so unique. And also you could see the potential, because they were out of training for 3 years and they come back and they still have this strength. So that also gives us so much energy. It's something that I think Team Amani, I would say, small team with big dream. I mean, our partners are behind us, like those factor, all these Rafa, Physique, all these like Dolphin, all those sponsors we have. It's just all in SRAM. Those are the partners we have now. Like, just they push us to dream big and to push us to be able to create this dream. And we are like looking also for giant companies that to invest in us, and like billionaires, just to show like the world. So it's something I will say, like myself and Mikael, like when we talk about this dream and to connect those 10 years plan, like now I feel like we're really growing so fast.
I know that you're very realistic, aren't you? I don't want to say cautious, but you, no one knows better than you what it takes.
Yeah. And also I think the good thing is like, I know where the world of cycling is. Yeah. I know how much money it needed to build a pro athlete. It's not cycling in my time and before, I think it was all about how much good you can climb, how good climber you are. You could, if you have watts per kilo, you could be like really good athlete. And it's like, but now it's not all about climbing. It's a lot of things that you need to put together within the athlete. So it's like, it's I'm aware of that. And I'm also under stress that to be able to connect those dots, to be able to make them to race. For example, next year we're going to come to race in Europe with the women. And I know in Europe, there is no easy race. in the main side, where, for example, we try to send them to Asia, to all African races, because there is more possibility for us to go there. And also in the same thing, we can try to build a confidence, how to race, winning mentality. And I don't want them to come to Europe and they just don't finish the race, or like they're hanging behind. And I know that change, that like if you hanging and you could give up easily, if you be able to perform, gives you so much energy. So as a coaches, as a team, it gives us so much energy. But with the women, we are trying to do different things also back in Ethiopia, in Kenya. We try to build races and make them to race with the men mixed and stuff like that. We have amazing plans to be able to make them ready for April when they come to Europe. So my journey was more difficult than this dream. Because it's I know where I come from, every step, every people what was telling me and what the whole world was thinking. There was no one, like there was no one who see 2012, they would become some African athletes to race in Europe. You know, it's a, it was not really like nobody see it coming, and we tried to chase it. Like African cycling was missing a team like that, just put together.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, I really should have asked you this first, but I'm going to ask you this question last. Just explain to people what is the difference between Armani, what you're doing, and what we've seen before with teams like MTN Quebeca.
So there is huge difference, I would say. There is big difference. I think there was two teams exist from Africa, I would say 2008, maybe 2007, Butterwood. This team from South Africa was, then MTN Quebeca come, was doing maybe better, like half from the whole team, five African athletes, we were there, like colored athletes really. And like, there was like from South Africa, but was run by, so when I was there, for example, there was Swanius from Germany, sport director Jens de Mecke from Germany, and stuff like from European. And it was just, we know the team was really focused on European, and they have open opportunity to people like me. For example, like I will never forget my turning point was MTN Quebeca for me. It's a few athletes also, like we come through that process. But they were not really 100% that like investing and more in athletes of like African athletes. And in Team Armani, because that's what was happening and like to what we try to do is completely different thing with like building only African athletes, like only colored athletes to be able to race for this team. We have no place for someone from Europe. We have no some place for any outside of colored people in the team. And that makes it different compared to them. And so when we want to see, when we want to do, like, for example, Tour de France, we want to do 100% African riders. And also, possibly, I'm working on the sport director side because I know there is the best Western sport director that know what to do, but I don't think so they give the right pressure, the right communication, the right thing to be able to put to the riders from those African athletes. So I'm trying to build also ex-pro athletes to be able to, they become a pro Conti. I had a conversation, for example, with Daniel Teclaim on it. I'm trying to make him on board to be able to work with me as a sport director to lead the team and other pro like me, and we try to build this team also on that. And we are also, I will say, smart enough to know, for example, I am open to bring European coaches because there is a lot of knowledge there. They know what to do with the cycling, so we are open for that also, to invest on those, the best coaches in the world, to come to Team Armani and build the fitness and build the performance. So we have a team from Europe, from America, that they work on the performance side, but we are really focused on mechanics, soigners, sport director, and the riders has to be colors. We could be open like until we grow, like also on the sport director side. One thing we will never change is like only for the riders that has to be really colored and pure African athletes. In Ethiopia, we are opening Black Mamba, which is the second team. And also in Uganda, Rwanda is already. So we try to work also with the UCI. The UCI also try to support like with those development, like how we could put together to be able to achieve this. I think the team is completely different what we were doing with MTN Quebeca. It's huge, huge difference. And it's something also unique that never happened before. So yeah, we're getting there slowly.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.
This episode of Unfiltered is brought to you by Google Gemini. U.S. college students get Gemini's Pro Plan free for 1 year and use the best model in the world for multimodal understanding. So whether you're uploading a video to get feedback on your presentation, uploading a photo of your homework to ask for extra help, or transcribing notes from a lecture you missed, Gemini 3 Pro can help. I'm honestly so happy and excited for all the college students out there because I wish this was around back when I was in school. This is such a game changer and so useful. I'm honestly a little jealous. So if you want to try it out, sign up to get more access to Google's most accurate model, Gemini 3 Pro. Unlimited image uploads, pro-level image editing, higher limits in Notebook LM, Gemini in Gmail and Docs, 2 terabytes of storage, and more. All you have to do is visit gemini.google/students to learn more and sign up. Terms apply.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel, or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of U.S. soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.